Brian Horn is Director of Athletic Performance at Wake Forest Basketball. In this interview, we discuss the uniqueness of basketball as a sport, developing athletes over four-year cycles, and what it's like to navigate through a long season on the road. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fuss. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
Welcome back to the Well Traveled Wellness Podcast. Today we're calling across to one of my favorite places in the world, North Carolina, and to speak to Ryan Horn, Director of Athletic Performance of the men's basketball team at Wake Forest University. I'm pretty excited to talk to someone in basketball. I think this is actually our first time doing that on the podcast. And just to hear an American accent is pretty refreshing. So welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thanks for having me on. It seems to have done a couple podcasts in the past, and I've been like the first basketball guy they've ever spoke to. So either basketball strength conditioning coaches aren't getting it done at a high level and nobody wants to talk to us, or, you know, we're doing a good enough job now where people are branching out and want to listen to us. I don't know which one it is yet. It's funny you make a comment about the accent thing as well, because in the States, it's almost required to have an accent to do any type of sports science work and to run Excel. So, I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, that's awesome. Tell us a bit about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, you know, growing up, you know, I was really into training. My brother was a bodybuilder, competitive bodybuilder. So I grew up in the weight room and grew up with a bunch of old timers that liked to train. And you know, we didn't have cell phones and guys actually trained hard, and it was fun. And I learned from those guys, and you know, it kind of caught the iron bug early. And, you know, all through high school, I played a multitude of sports, mostly football. And, you know, using what I learned in the weight room with some of those guys, and had a great high school football coach that got us started off on the right foot from a strength conditioning perspective, and really fell in love with the training and the preparation and carried that through college. You know, had a chance to do an internship in strength conditioning and wanted to give it a shot because I knew it was something I've always been interested in, and just felt like a perfect fit. I truly believe that certain people are built to do certain things, and I think this is my calling and my duty and something that I feel comfortable and something that I really enjoy that I have a passion for. So it's a good fit. So yeah, we started at Robert Morris University as an intern, was there for some internship, got a graduate assistant position at Virginia Commonwealth University, which turned into a full-time position with Tim Kontos, and then left there. Went to the University of Tulsa for 3 years. I was at VCU for five. Went to the University of Tulsa for 3 years. Then we came to Wake Forest in 2014. So we're currently starting our third season here at Wake Forest, and looking forward to another year.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm a bit jealous. I think North Carolina is like one of the best spots on earth. Well, just the Carolinas. I love Charleston as well, but
yeah,
I've got family in Wilmington and visit as often as I can. And the Outer Banks are just magical.
It's beautiful. It's a great area to be in. I'm not going to complain at all.
I even think Asheville is one of the most underrated towns in the country. So it's just a cool state.
It's phenomenal. It's a good time, man. Plenty of good beer, good music, good activities. So yeah, it's great.
And the food. How can you forget the food? So what? I guess let's kind of lead off with what we just spoke about in the intro, Ryan. Is basketball? What's unique about basketball SNC, and what should people know about how you need to and how you do apply? You know, everything you've learned and all of your experience to enhancing the performance of basketball athletes.
You know, I think basketball presents itself with a lot of different unique challenges that are very rewarding to kind of confront and take head on. You know, I've worked with a ton of different sports over the course of my career, and I'm really glad I had a chance to do that, not just work with your typical football and basketball. You know, I was highly influenced by track and field, and I've worked a lot of different field sports with soccer and field hockey, even though I didn't realize when I first started out that hockey was played off ice. It was also played on grass, which was
a shock. I still refuse to believe that. Yeah.
So it was a shocker to me early on, but yeah, so, you know, having a chance to work with a variety of not only cultures from a team and sports perspective with a lot of different female, male athletes, it's been kind of an organic process with me. Like I said before, you know, I can't shoot a jump shot. I wasn't a basketball player. But I enjoy it tremendously due to the fact that I have small numbers. I'm training anywhere between 14 to 16 guys on a yearly basis, which allows me to do a lot of different things from a sports science to training and a coaching piece. I get to develop fantastic relationships with the athletes. I don't have to worry about a small group of guys. And I'm with these athletes 24/7. It's the only sport that I train. So I travel with them. We get to have very small groups. So the athlete to coach ratio is phenomenal. And I think we really get a chance to embrace and facilitate improvements in performance, not only physically, but also psychologically and emotionally with what we're trying to do on the court in the weight room because of those small numbers. Now, on the flip side of that, you know, I'm training guys that are anywhere between 5'11 all the way up to 7'2". So a generic cookie cutter program isn't going to necessarily work very well in basketball. It takes some time to learn how to train longer limbed athletes. If you've seen any of my videos or any of the videos that we post with stuff that we do training wise, our guys train, we work to develop them. They're in the weight room. They do train with barbells, which is sometimes this is a shocker for some people with basketball. I truly believe this sport in general, why I love training it is they're so over-specialized. They're underfed, they're overworked, and they're over-specialized. So general training, solid, consistent training, whether it's sprints, jumps, throws, the Olympic lifts, getting them stronger, increasing body armor, just making them more robust athletes is a simple process and application, but it takes some art and some ingenuity as far as how you tailor that to fit these longer-limbed athletes. But I just really enjoy training these guys because I feel like they spend so much time on the court and everybody labels them as they don't like to be in the weight room. But the fact of the matter is they just haven't been exposed to it on a consistent basis. And that's reflective of the leadership and the program that you have them under. So I find it very rewarding. But it's a hard sport to train for. You got long, explosive, dynamic athletes that have a lot of energy system requirements as well. And they have to be explosive and they have a big skill component. It's an extremely long season with very small windows to train and prepare them. So yeah, I'm blessed and I'm cursed at the same time. But I wouldn't have it any other way.
I find it's an interesting one that, like, people always talk about how soccer has such a culture change that's needed to get them to love, you know, lifting weights.
Yeah.
I think basketball is just as egregious.
Yeah, I think so. And I would agree with you just because, you know, with the game, I mean, the guys are playing pickup basketball. You know, I've said it all the time in different podcasts that I've been on. You know, my guy, you know, when I played football, we never went out and put shoulder pads and helmets on to play pickup.
Right.
We definitely weren't doing it 5, 6, 7 times a week. So these guys are always on the court. It's a skill dominant game. It's also a very selfish in preparation just because one guy in these high schools that these kids are coming from, they can dominate and change a team with just one guy. So they're averaging over 100 games a year and they spend all their time on the court. So all their physical tools have been generated both from an energy system standpoint and from a overall, biomotor as far as power, speed, and things of that nature are concerned. It's all developed on the court and through specialized means, which makes them heavily skilled. But when it comes to resiliency and durability, it could be a crutch long term.
I found it really interesting, kind of the stress balance in basketball. We were really lucky. The Oklahoma City Thunder passed through the facility 2 weeks ago. I was chatting with their strength coach, David Howarth, who is from Sydney.
I know Andrew. I knew Andrew Paul. He's one of the physical therapists on staff. He's phenomenal.
Oh, okay. Yep. Yeah. They had a squad in, and I realized how massive Steven Adams is and all that. But I was talking with David Howarth and just speaking about how, like, the amount of jumps and landings and accelerations and decelerations that these guys are doing. As much as we come in the room and want to train them, we do have a pretty big responsibility to make sure that they are, ready to play and that they're recovered from everything that they're doing. And well, there is no recovering properly if they're playing every 3 days and all of that. So, how do you kind of balance that mess that we have to deal with in such sports?
I think when you look at basketball, I mean, the difference in NBA basketball as season rolls around. Then once you get in the NCAA tournament, you can play upwards of the, you know, high 40s as far as the number of games you can play. So on an NBA scale, it's not nearly as many games that we have to manage and play damage control from. I also have more contact with these athletes. They get a total of, you know, roughly 5 to 6 weeks off a year, and it's never for more than 2 weeks at a time. So I feel like the issue of detraining and the balance between acute and chronic load or training stress balance is much more conducive to preparation overall. So that's a big difference between the NBA and college. But with me, it's one of those things we have to understand. Yes, 90% of their year is spent competing or practicing or playing the game of basketball, but we do have some windows within that time frame in the spring and also in that summer period where we're able to basically, you know, put a stress on these athletes in a different way. Now, when you talk about the impacts and things like that, we have to prep them for that, but they have to understand too that they're playing a game of basketball, which is nothing more than an hour or 2 hour plyometric session anyways. So I'm under the facet of, you know, the legend Al Vermeil, in the sense that we derive a lot of our explosive strength and power movements off the Olympic lifts, some barbell squat jumps early on in prep, and some different, you know, multi-jumping rudiments to build a good base to help these athletes facilitate not only recovery, but also to prepare them so we can protect them. We can manage readiness all we want, but if these guys don't have a great level of base preparation and they're not prepared to handle the demands that we're going to put them through, then the readiness isn't going to matter. You know, 70% of shit, I'm sorry, excuse my language. You know, if I make sure he's at 100% and his 100% is crap and it's not going to hold up, you know, we're put in a bad spot. So I think in the summertime, I have this understanding that I want to force adaptation. Our guys' readiness isn't going to be phenomenal. We're going to force adaptation. We're going to train them. They're going to be in a state of fatigue, and it's by design. And then the NCAA gives us our little breaks where these guys have 2 to 3 week span of breaks a couple times a year, and we make sure they go into those breaks in a way where they can recover, they can compensate, and they can come back and further increase their physical development. But two, we have to understand that the training load piece, you know, and Dr. Gabbett says this, you know, it's not necessarily what the training load is, it's how you get there. So we're very cognizant of making sure we have a consistent application of stress over time without these dramatic decreases or increases in volume on an acute scale, and not have two extended layoffs to kind of help set the table, so to speak. So it's definitely a multifaceted and kind of a multifactorial, you know, type endeavor. But I think if you have a great system in place as far as communication is concerned with your sports medicine and your coaching staff, it can definitely be done. Now, we're not perfect by any stretch of the means, but I think we're definitely heading in the right direction.
What's something that you've learned and changed your mind on in the 3 years that you've been at Wake Forest?
I think taking over Wake Forest, you know, coming from smaller schools, you know, I was more at your what we would call mid-majors, that they're the smaller programs that aren't your typical Power Five or Blue Blood in the NCAA, if people aren't familiar with that. So, you know, in smaller schools, you're not getting as great of athletes, you know, skill level, attitude, ego, rankings, you know, all those things don't factor in as much. So when I got to Wake Forest, you know, we understand that not only the demand at which these athletes are playing, but just the level of competition. The level of competition increases the structural stress and the load from which the athletes we were going against. The type of mentality that the kids had was a little bit different, because we did take over a program that we're currently rebuilding. So it had to teach me a lot in the sense of not only modifying and understanding that I'm having young kids that are freshmen that need to play right away, so the opportunity to slow cook them and develop them is somewhat hard because they have to be ready to play right away. Then we had older guys that hadn't been as successful, but are 4 years in the system. So just balancing at Wake Forest, just balancing the different needs and demands, but also dealing with the fact that we were trying to improve culture and have a change and how we did things and teach these athletes to, you know, kind of conduct themselves in a way that we felt is conducive to winning ball games. And we haven't turned the corner yet, but I definitely think we're heading in that right direction. So a lot of it wasn't necessarily training. It wasn't, you know, X's and O's. A lot of it was just, you know, how do we set the table and how do we implement this? But there's been a lot of change as far as how we program, and we see that every year is different. What I notice now, we've had a lot of turnover. So the system is in place, but how we've applied it from summer to summer based on the first year guys that know how to put clips on the bar. So you can take your, you know, triphasic models and all these different periodization schemes and throw them out the window because the guys just didn't know how to change. or how to train, excuse me, didn't know how to move. So we had to start slow and build them from there. And then now as we've progressed and added pieces along the way, we've definitely, you know, changed how we view. But I've definitely, my vision and my system of how I train basketball players has definitely evolved since I've been here, just because the access to the resources we've had and the things we've been able to do. I think it's allowed us to really open our minds and have a good perspective as far as how we prepare our athletes.
Can you expand a bit on that in terms of the systems that you put in place and some of the checks and balances you might build, Ryan? I think one of the number one things that you'll kind of stereotypically see someone fresh out of undergrad go and say or do is, you know, they want to slap some beautiful 16-week periodized program.
Oh, of course it.
And yeah. And then it's like, wait a second, if you have a one and done who doesn't know how to put the clips on the bar, how is that going to work? And how do you have any idea how he's going to adapt or learn? He might learn quickly. He might learn slowly. He might break, you know, he might be able to take anything you can throw at him. So how do you, I mean, it's great that you have an awesome, athlete to coach ratio. It's quite similar to rugby sevens, actually. In that, I mean, we have seven on the pitch at a time and usually travel with a squad of 12 to 14, you know, so that's nice. But how do you build a system while still kind of individualizing? Where's the middle ground?
Yeah, I think the system goes back to, like, what are your standards? How is your program tailored? What are your athletes going to be able to do to be successful under your coaching staff? So you could call 15 different basketball programs, and depending on the style of play, the type of athletes that they get, that's going to determine how they train their athletes. So for us, it's important that we have baseline as far as what our athlete profile needs to be, not only individually, but also positionally based. What demands do we need to place on these student athletes and what they need to be able to do from a biomotor and a bioenergetic standpoint? And then what biomechanical limitations or structural limitations or injury history do these athletes have that can prevent them from, as far as what training stress you're able to apply and what do they have? So when you look at these different buckets or modules during that athlete profiling process, I think you have to start, number one, I don't know how you can write a program, a 16-week program, for someone you've never trained and or tested. And you don't know what gaps you need to fill, what genetic traits they have or what physical abilities they have that are weak, which ones do they have that you need to improve. So I think for us, our system is understanding that we have, basically it's black and white in a lot of areas as far as basic biomotor testing, you know, height, reach, you know, anthropometric testing, you know, cardiac screening, going through our medical process, go through a functional movement screen or fusion genetics, depending on, we use a fusion genetics in our athletic training staff or physical therapist, puts them through a functional movement screen. You can say what you want about that, but that's the test that he's comfortable with and he uses that information. So I'm okay with it and I support it 100%. And then we go from there and they get to us, you know, then we're going to look at all the fun stuff. So sprints, jumps, reactive elastic, you know, capabilities, reactive strength index, body composition. We were talking earlier before we got on, you know, we use DEXA scans, to look at our guys' body composition. Then we're looking at force plate scans as far as how they interact with gravity. How do they land? How do they balance? How do they jump in a jumping sport? That's very important information. And then looking at how they move and then taking them through a base program, a 4 to 6 week block when they first step on campus, no matter where they come from, and understanding how do they respond to training? How do they respond to stress? And then where they're at physically during that evaluation process. So I think the system itself is knowing what you can teach as a coach, you know, as far as what you can coach, what you can believe in. We're all limited by our experience, what your head coach's vision for the program is, and then establishing an athlete profile for each individual athlete that you can look at, then adjust from year to year, month to month, over a long-term process. Most of the guys I get, I'm getting them anywhere from between 2 to 5 years. Over that period, where did the athlete start? What do we need to do to get better? And what are type of red flags or risk profile does this athlete have? And once we understand our, you know, their preparedness, and once we look at their risk profile, then it's a lot easier to manage their readiness during the season, during the competition year. So I think for us, the system becomes of knowing what you need to train in the first place and then filling the gaps appropriately. But just saying, like, this guy's a point guard and this guy's a point guard, so they should train the same because they play the same position. Well, this guy could be 6'4", 215-pound point guard, and this guy could be a 5'11", you know, 175-pound soaking wet, fresh out of high school. There's a big difference between those athletes. So while they play the same position, physically they're not the same. Mentally they're not the same, and then their testing is going to reflect that. So I think that's the biggest thing for me is having, you know, yeah, definitely.
Oh, I like the sound of that, Ryan. And I think building, you know, systems from within which you create, you know, kind of that context for in like the risk profiling as you spoke about. That's really neat. And I'm a big fan of that kind of, if I heard you right, that kind of do not pass go, do not collect $200 type of initial program, which everyone exactly. has to go through. Like, I'm such a fan of that. So we're trying that right now with Bay of Plenty Rugby Sevens at the moment. So it's kind of in between seasons for the national teams, and the provincial teams are running now. We've got some, yeah, pretty much the same who are fresh out of high school. And have never touched a barbell. And we've got some who just got back from the Olympics, you know, and are just integrating into their provincial team. Tracking back though, I have one selfish question before we go into kind of our wrap up. And that is, I'm fascinated in sports in which speed as a concept is very, very essential. But the athletes don't really reach top speed. And even in your sports like soccer and rugby, the athletes might reach top speed once a game, or, you know, your outside backs, maybe, you know, they might have a 40 meter sprint two or three times in the match. But basketball, do they ever make more than five steps in a row in the same direction? No,
you know, in the game of basketball, from a, you know, when you do kind of a match analysis and you're kind of looking at the biodynamic kind of structure of what they're doing in the sport, you can't run for more than 3 seconds. It's almost impossible without changing direction. That's just the length of the court. Most of the majority of the movement, is lateral. Your bigs are going to excel a little bit more than your guards do, but your guards are going to have a much more dominant XL, D-cell, component. So there's a lot of change direction. There's a lot of movement, not to mention the fact that you either have someone on you or a ball in your hand, which also changes the mechanics. But I view it as this, yes, they're not reaching, they have these operational outputs. In the words of James Smith, talked about this in a seminar that he had years ago. The difference between maximal and operational outputs, you know, these guys are operating, at whatever that speed threshold. Like, for instance, for our SportView data, we use SportView for some of our in-game tracking, and we also use Catapult. Our best guards might hit a top speed of 18 to 19 miles an hour in a game. Boom. And that might be like some of them, I could have pushed them. Who knows? But anyways, they might hit that top speed. They can hit that in training. My goal from an aspect of speed development is to understand if I can increase their maximal outputs in training, and I can, you know, create a demand that allows them to express force, more efficiently and at higher levels. You know, my opinion is when they do get on the court, they're operating at a lower percentage of their max. They're stronger. They're more mechanically efficient. When they excel and decel, they have the eccentric strength. You know, whether we're using K boxes or, you know, some type of eccentric rate of force development, they're able to stop, decelerate, and handle that over and over and over again. You know, that's where you kind of set that platform. So even though I've had this discussion before, we do speed training early on in the summer, where we're focusing on power development and speed development, and we transition to more capacity related activities when we get closer to competition. But I do put a premium early on in preparation on speed, both loaded and unloaded, both uphill runs, towing sleds, and unloaded runs, just to increase those windows and those thresholds for speed. I think that's an output that we can't get in the weight room. I think it's a great training quality. We stick within the 10 to 30 meter distance. And we, focus on acceleration, because that's what our game is. So we'll work on some deceleration, which I think also has a huge maximal strength component that we'll train in the weight room as well. And then we'll also look on acceleration and work those different qualities. And I think it really does set the platform and set the table, and give these athletes a good, a good base to work off of.
Yeah, I'm always interested in the pedagogical approach that different coaches take, Ryan, because I find it fascinating that, like, I like to beat that drum, which it sounds like you do too, of, kind of, if we can train high velocities, then they're going to be robust at high velocities in the games, which is great and is a huge part of what I think we should be doing. However, some of the game-breaking movements related to speed will be at maximum effort, but definitely not maximum velocity.
Oh, not at all.
Depending about a guard weaving from the key to the basket, not moving in a straight line. He's not moving at maximal speed. So how do we train that unless we're some absolute biomechanical wizard?
Yeah, I think you look at that. You look at how you train. I think what we've changed a little bit since we've been here is, we've gotten away from pre-programmed change of direction work. We use the fusion timing system, and we do a lot of reactive gait work and getting our athletes to put their foot in the ground and be not only fast movers, but also fast thinkers, and get them to process information at high speed. But I think too, like in the game, when I look at training, I look at filling the gaps. I know what speed these guys work at during pickup and during practice and during games. I know the type of movements they make on the court, and I know what they're getting at extremely high volumes and levels. It's my job to fill the gaps. So I'm not going to do more drills that mimic basketball and have it be a glorified practice session. So my idea and our staff's idea is to look at what type of horsepower, what type of engine can we have? Do we have the strength to even excel and decel in the first place? You know, and what type of profile does this athlete have? So if we have athletes, for instance, if they're standing vertical, if there's extreme discrepancy between a standing vert and an approach vert or a max vert, then we know these athletes are a little bit more reactive elastics, which lets us know they're going to excel and decel pretty decently. But also if they lack starting strength and absolute strength and their eccentric rate of forcement or their eccentric utilization rate shows off, then we know they're setting up themselves for injury. Because most of the injuries that I see in basketball isn't when they're taking off or jumping or going up. It's when they're coming back down or they're putting their foot in the ground, Euro step, hop step. So all these movements, I mean, these athletes, and you don't have to cut it out. I mean, they are extremely weak. You know, I see guys that come in, they can't do a single leg deadlift. They can't do a body weight squat. They basically they're all gas, no brakes. And to think that they can just keep on playing and doing what they're doing, they're just dodging the bullet and they're hoping and wishing, which isn't a good preparation program, to hope and wish things work out. And, I would like to take as much of that gray area out as possible and understand the impact that we can have and go from there. But the last thing you can do with an over-specialized athlete is throw more fuel on that fire when they're already on a small and insufficient base as it is from a GPP's perspective.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's smart. I think we need to look more and work with our physio and our medical staff more on looking at when athletes get injured. So we will have to bring you back soon for part two. Ryan Horn, thank you for your time today.
No problem. I appreciate you having me on and look forward to our continued correspondence. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you leave a review on iTunes, you'll get a free coaching session with me. Check back soon for interviews with Michael Roncarati and Justin Crow.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.